Hello, welcome to Greenlit with me, the voice which belongs to Toby Earle. In each episode of Greenlit, a guest receives the thrilling news their life is to be made into a biopic, and we discuss how that story will be told. Will they star? Which moments won't make it into the adaptation? And will there be zombies? In this episode, journalist, writer, playwright, and broadcaster Danny Robbins will plot the course of this certain blockbuster. Robbins is the UK's foremost paranormal investigator. His smash hits including the Radio 4 series The Battersea Poltergeist, The Witch Farm, and Uncanny, which now has an accompanying BBC Two series. Uncanny begins the second leg of its live tour at the end of May, and details can be found at uncannylive.com. And Uncanny USA begins on BBC Sounds on the 30th of April. Robbins is also the writer of the hit play 222, A Ghost Story. He once came second in the UK Air Guitar Championships, he's had a top 20 single, and he's never met anyone called James. Danny Robbins, welcome to Greenlit.
Hello. One of those statements is not true.
The question is, which one? And maybe listeners should just be left wondering.
But I want to start with a Road to Damascus conversion moment here.
Oh,
biopic. I always said biopic, and I've just realized I've been saying it wrong my entire life.
This was a key question every guest was asked. Is it biopic or biopic?
Is it like tomato, tomato? Should we call the whole thing off?
This is the shortest episode ever. No one's ever asked to call it off this early into the conversation. That is a heck of a record, Danny.
I'm a stickler for pronunciation. But no, I feel like I've been saying it wrong my whole life.
People make arguments for both.
Oh, is this a contentious point then?
It's a contentious point because biopic, like biography, or does it sound a little bit medical? Does biopic sound a bit medical?
Yeah, I had to go in for a biopic the other day. Yeah.
Yeah, this is it. There's people have their different opinions. And that was something, you know, we were keen to really nail down in this podcast.
I think that should be the subject of a podcast in itself. Have voices been raised in anger over this on your podcast?
Sometimes the conversation has gone on longer than we intended. And
like now. Do you know the Tom Baker tarpaulin story?
I desperately want to now.
So Tom Baker, as in the great seminal Doctor Who, was recording an advert for a garden centre, and he had to list the products they were selling. And he was like, you know, we sell fences and decking and tarpaulin. And the producer went, sorry, Tom, just to pick you up, it's tarpaulin. And he went, no, the word is tarpaulin. It's correctly pronounced tarpaulin. And I went, most people say tarpaulin, Tom, so if we could just go for tarpaulin. And anyway, this kind of went back and forth, and eventually it ends with Tom Baker going, I will not say tarpaulin! And so when the advert went out, apparently it went, we've got fences, decking, and tarpaulin! They'd pulled that bit, used it in the edit. So I love that. So if you want, you can have me going, biopic!
I think you've just written yourself into the fabric of the podcast now, because we'll just bash that out as a sound effect every now and again during the conversation.
Gordon's alive. Biopic. the biopic man. Anyway, look,
Danny, you're a very successful writer, playwright. I understand the Battersea Poltergeist is in development. Is that right?
I think in development is the crucial thing. It's been in development for a very long time. It was very exciting. The Battersea Poltergeist, for anyone who doesn't know, was the podcast I made for the BBC about a real life ghost story in the 1950s, and did really well as a podcast, and then had this bidding war around it from lots of film and TV companies for the rights. And you know, talking about making a movie of your life, I mean, it felt like a scene from a movie of my life. You know, it was so exciting, kind of talking to Hollywood people, and Blumhouse, these big Hollywood horror producers, came in. And you know, I've heard the expression that every meeting you have with an American will be the best meeting of your life. And it was really like that. I mean, it was just amazing, you know, like so exciting. And yeah, I mean, it's with them, but it's been in development hell for a long time. And it's kind of, we've been through lots of exciting moments where it got very close, and then now it's kind of stalled. But I remain hopeful that something will happen. And, you know, Blumhouse have been great and lovely to work with, and you know, very exciting. And, you know, I found myself having lunch with Jason Blum himself at his mansion in Santa Monica. And, you know, that was a moment for the movie of my life.
there can't be anyone more suited to have something stuck in development hell than you, surely, than the, given some of the, you lift the veil regularly. So surely this is like, it's a comfortable place to be, development hell in some ways.
I know. Definitely. I sort of wander through a purgatory of treatments and first drafts.
Well, you mentioned there about having lunch with Jason Blum in his mansion in Santa Monica. And I wonder, because, you know, Danny, the film of your life is being made. Where would you have those meetings with those executives? Because, you know, would you have it somewhere where you feel like you've kind of got the sort of control, it's a place that's very comfortable, or would you make them want to flash the cash a bit and take you somewhere snazzy? Where would you ideally like to be for that meeting?
I think one thing I've learned from writing drama over the years is that the great thing about drama as opposed to real life is that you can make it more exciting. You know, you can emphasize things, you can magnify things, you can, you know, just make everything kind of bigger and badder and bolder and more scary. So I think I would have those meetings in a helicopter flying over the Alps, possibly dangling from it, actually. I think actually dangling from a helicopter would be a great way to incentivize people to actually commission your program. And now, as I'm saying this, I'm now thinking that's possibly something to bring into real life there. You know, is that like that Alan Partridge moment, you know, like, give me a second series, you shit, you know? Like, you know, give me another series or I will dangle you out of my chopper. That sounded way ruder than I intended.
This has taken quite a turn. I wasn't expecting...
Danny got his chopper out in the development meeting again. But I think it's a crucial question to ask yourself when making a movie of your life, you know, to what degree it's truthful. You know, like, a lot of biopics are really not very truthful at all. I mean, I watched the Notorious Big film, you know, which basically is a kind of hagiography to him and Puff Daddy. I mean, it, you know, makes them look like saints. And there was a kind of spate of films a bit like that at that time. The NWA one as well. I mean, I was a real teenage rap fan, so I had an interest in that kind of stuff. I was a big NWA fan. But, you know, they were very sanitized movies. I mean, I enjoyed that one, but I think, you know, very, very sanitized movies. And it's a challenge, isn't it? You know, there was that Michael Jordan show, the Last Dance as well, which again I thought was brilliant, but I think it took some criticism for sort of being too kind on Jordan. I think it was produced by his company and people said it didn't sort of, it wasn't warts and all. And it is a challenge, you know, do you go warts and all? How honest do you go? I mean, do you suffer by making yourself look too good, basically?
That's not probably what many people ask themselves when they're making a film about their lives. Can I be too good? That can't be possible for some people. They cannot be too good.
But I think vanity is a dangerous thing then. And someone told me a story, a director told me a story about working with a really big name talent who doesn't work so much anymore. I won't name the person, but someone who used to be on our screens a lot and isn't so much anymore. And he said he sat in an edit suite with this guy, and this guy forced him to basically edit everybody else out of the TV program. So he wanted every other actor to be only seen in kind of profile or the back of their heads. He wanted it to always be on him. And of course, it was a kind of form of madness, and the program was rubbish as a result, and therefore sabotaged the career of the famous lead, you know. So I think, you know, vanity is a bad thing. And I think those moments where nobody criticizes you and nobody holds you to account are possibly the kind of the seeds of the end of your success. You know, I think you need to be in a state of being challenged and having, you know, people restrain you from things.
If you don't show sides to you that are less appealing or flawed, how relatable can you be as a human being to other people?
I think that's really astute. And I think, you know, perfection isn't interesting. You know, we find imperfections interesting. You know, it's the gaps where the light gets in. And I think it's really important, I think, you know, since time immemorial, you know, we're interested in flawed heroes, that kind of, you know, the idea of hamartia in Greek tragedy, that kind of fatal flaw that brings down the hero. You know, I think it's a crucial thing. And I think, you know, one thing I kind of find myself consciously doing in the stuff I make is sort of showing the reality, showing my real life. You know, you kind of see my kids, you see my wife, you see, you know, I was heavily criticized for wearing socks and sandals on the Uncanny TV series, you know, but hey, that's me. That's, what you see is what you get. You know, I think, I don't know, I'm fascinated by realness. And I think, you know, in my work, I make scary stuff. And I think for me, I find realness very scary. The realer something feels, the more believable it is, the more likely it is to scare the pants off me. And I think the polished, kind of airbrushed, photoshopped perfection just bores people, I think.
But firstly, thank you so much for bringing hamartia into the conversation. We've not had enough words describing aspects of ancient Greek tragedy in this podcast. I'd say that is this podcast hamartias, that we've not had enough. Maybe there's too much hubris going on.
Well, there you go. I like to raise the level of discussion here.
Yeah. And then also then, you know, you've dangled the executives outside of the helicopter in order to make a decision.
Yeah.
Would you then want to, and you're talking about like the fact that people being too good on screen is boring, which I thoroughly agree with, because, you know, hagiographies are dull and people see right through it. It's obvious. Would you then want people to know if this was a authorized or unauthorized biopic or biopic, whichever way you want it? Because some people might find the unauthorized thing slightly more juicy, potentially, because if people haven't given it the kind of sign off.
The problem with unauthorized, though, is it's often kind of restrained by that as well. Like, I mean, do you remember Kurt and Courtney, the Nick Broomfield film?
Yeah.
You know, really interesting movie about Kurt Cobain, but at the last minute, Courtney Love stopped Nick Broomfield from using any Nirvana music. And it was really kind of odd as a result. It was kind of, you know, really noticeable by its absence that the thing that they were talking about, Nirvana's amazing music, wasn't there. So I think, I don't know, I think authorized is better because you get better access. You can actually kind of, you know, dive into that person's treasure trove of archive and memories and all that kind of thing. But you need to have a relationship with the person who authorizes it that they aren't going to be restraining you and kind of sitting over your shoulder all the time. So I think I would walk away from the process. I'd authorize it and I'd walk away and say, look, you know, tell what you believe is the truth. I'm here if you need to ask me questions, but most of the time I'll be dangling people out of helicopters.
Well, exciting news. Your life has been greenlit for a biopic. But how would your life be told by Hollywood or Bollywood or Nollywood? And what sort of creative control would you exercise in bringing the greatest story you know to the big screen? Danny Robbins, first big question. What's the film called? What is the authorized biopic of Danny Robbins' life called?
I've got a list of titles to run past you. I feel like this is the initial moment where we blue sky, and then that great word often used in development, to see what we can work out for the best title. We're going to raise the flag, see his salutes. So I've got Danny the Champion of the World, Danny Geddon, the Danny Manator, Danny't Look Now, Danny Hall, Danny Kenstein, Danny Killer, the Dan in the Iron Mask, Super Dan, Lady Windermere's Dan, Dante's Inferno, Danny Panheimer, or Police Dan Academy 5 Assignment Danami Beach. So that's a list of possibles, but I'm veering towards Uncanny Danny. What do you think?
Ooh, I know in some ways it might feel reductive to sort of just purely associate you with just one thing that you've made over the years, but from a commercial point of view, there's no mistaking who that is, right? That is you. People know it's like Danny Champion of the World's brilliant. That's right. And I love Danny Geddon and Dante's Inferno. Absolutely. Again, you're raising the bar here.
With a little Police Academy reference chucked in.
But Uncanny Danny, that is just, I mean, marketing would embrace you, I feel. Marketing would embrace you.
It's always been a little bit of a play on words for me as well, because I grew up in the Northeast, where you say that things are canny if they're good. And so it's kind of like a little subtle nod that's there for all the Northeasterners. You know, gan canny, you say, like, go well, you know, so I'm going to gan uncanny.
I have often wondered if uncanny in the Northeast means something that isn't good, because obviously something as good as canny, but like is uncanny, does that mean it's not good?
I think that they're much more to the point than that, with words we probably couldn't say here right now. But I don't know. I mean, it's an interesting word, uncanny, isn't it? It's one of those words that, I mean, it's definitely a word that's hard to explain to people not from England. You know, like my in-laws are from Sweden. Like, you know, it's a complicated word. It sort of embodies a lot, uncanny, I think.
What about Undanny, if it's not unauthorized, you know?
Undanny. Yeah, I like it. Undanny.
Undanny.
Coming to a cinema near you.
Undanny. Are we going to go with Undanny? Would you go with Undanny?
Let's call it Undanny. I like that. Yeah, yeah.
Undanny.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you say you like puns. Has that been a part? I mean, you used to write a lot of comedy, right? And so has that been a part of your whole sort of career? Is that sort of how you fell in love with writing and you know, writing comedy?
I was once accused in a review in the Scotsman newspaper of my Edinburgh Festival show of Sean Punnery, which in itself was a pun, but as in Sean, as in S-H-O-R-N. Very clever. But I love a pun. I love wordplay. I love words, full stop. I love like alliteration and assonance. And I just really enjoy the rhythms of words. I think it's why I liked rap as a kid. I loved poetry as a kid as well. I loved being playful with words. And you know, I have early memories of my granddad and my dad telling me jokes and just, you know, enjoying the form of the joke. I think, you know, I still love the art form of the joke, the rhythm of the joke. I'm very unmusical. I'm so unmusical to the extent where I can't even clap in time. Like when I go and watch a musical, I have to air clap to pretend, so I'm not audibly clapping out of time. But I do think I feel the music of words. I feel the rhythm of words when I'm writing scripts. I kind of feel it flowing through me. I kind of feel like I know how the sentence needs to progress. And so, yes, I love all that. And I love a sort of a certain lyricism, you know, like I've always enjoyed the work of Harold Pinter, where, you know, it sort of feels like it's just slightly unnaturalistic. It's sort of a sort of heightened naturalism. I took that into my play 222, A Ghost Story, I think, you know, it's naturalistic dialogue, but there's just a certain kind of moments, sort of turns of phrase that just feels sort of slightly poetic, slightly lyrical. And I love doing that in my scripts for Uncanny as well. So I think I whoever wrote the story of my life, wrote the movie, I'd want them to kind of embrace a certain lyricism to it.
Oh, would you not write it yourself? Or if not, who would you like to write it?
Oh, gosh, well, no, I think isn't that dangerous to kind of write the script of your own, the movie of your life? I don't know. I think I'd probably...
Because that reminds me, because, you know, sorry to interrupt, but like, yeah. You know, there's that famous story, apocryphal or not, you know, that Kim Jong-un... The current North Korean dear leader, he played a perfect round of golf, didn't he? He got like a hole in one on every single hole. Like that's, you could add those things. You talked about sort of like taking it out of like the sort of realism. You could add that kind of stuff into your life. You can go, do you know what I've always wanted to do that. I've always wanted to like surf on the largest wave on earth, or, you know, climb the Empire State Building like King Kong. I mean, you could add that kind of thing. Or is there a writer you'd love to kind of helmet that would get, that kind of understands or kind of would sort of appreciate your worldview and your love of words?
Well, gosh, that's a really good question, isn't it? I'm also very, very bad at sharing, and I think I'm not a sort of natural collaborator. I'm a bit of a sort of obsessive control freak. So actually, I think I would, now you've raised this, I'm worrying about it, and I am thinking I would find it quite difficult. Actually, I'm so obsessively perfectionist about things in a sort of kind of probably unnecessary way, but just, you know, I'll spend days agonizing over one word in a script, you know, and I don't know. I think it might be important for me to be restrained and taken away from this. I think, you know, maybe during the production process, I should be locked in a padded room and kind of not allowed out until the film is finished and I can go and watch it. Normally when I go and watch things, when I've left people to it, I actually am happy with it, but it's the kind of backseat driving kind of stuff that I'm bad at.
You talked about your writing there, and I'm just curious because you've written so much, you've written so many different things over the years. You've worked with Basil Brush, you know, you've worked with the most, you know, the biggest fox in the country.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, you've got now this live tour. Do you remember the first thing that you wrote that you were like, that kind of filled your heart with joy, that you, whether it was you were really young, it was the first paid thing you did, or the first thing that kind of brought attention to you? What was that?
It's a good question. I mean, I found some stuff in my attic recently. I've just been doing a loft conversion, and all the stuff of my loft has been moved out. And I found things I wrote when I must have been about sort of 6 or 7. And you could really see, it was quite moving, actually. You could really see the kind of the sort of genius of somebody wanting to write, you know, to sort of start the kind of little seeds of somebody kind of crafting stories. And, you know, when they talk about that kind of 10,000 hours thing, you know, if you spend 10,000 hours doing something, you get good at it. That writing is the thing that I've just done again and again and again and again over my life, and been obsessed by and enjoyed. I remember writing a thing called The Mysterious Lodger when I was doing A-level theatre studies, which was a little kind of short comic play about a mysterious kind of invisible man style figure who turned up at a house. I think very influenced by Fry and Laurie. I was very into Fry and Laurie at the time, and probably with little bits of sort of shades of kind of Blackadder as well in there. And I definitely remember thinking it was the best thing ever. And I also remember going to university and getting to know Marcus Brigstocke, who people listening might now know, and Dan Tetzel, who I worked with a long time, my writing partner. We formed this little group called Club Seals, very poor taste name, but it was our Edinburgh comedy sketch team. And we were looking for sketch ideas, writing lots of ideas together. And I remember going, guys, I've got this thing. It's The Mysterious Lodger. It's like a fully formed short comic play. We could do that. And they were like, great, brilliant. So look at it. And I remember reading through it with them, and it was agonizing. It was like the worst sort of 5 minutes of my life. Like as I realized that this thing that I'd thought was great was actually really terrible. And it's funny, isn't it? Like when you look back at stuff from the past, I find it now, like I tried to show my kids He-Man the other day, having loved He-Man, the cartoon as a kid. And it was really terrible. It was really slow, really bad animation. And they looked at me and they were like, you know, questioning my entire judgment. Like, how did you ever think this was good? But the memory plays tricks on you. Memory is a sort of very fallible thing. You know, that's a lesson you should take into any kind of study of the paranormal, I guess, you know, that your memories are not always correct. But so the first thing I remember writing professionally and just, you know, feeling like, God, this is something I'm really happy with, was a show called We Are History. We were straight out of university and we made it for BBC Two. We were incredibly lucky. We managed to get this commission just through, I mean, we knew somebody who worked at BBC Bristol who showed it to their boss, who showed it to their boss. And eventually their boss went and sat in the office of the BBC Two commissioner and went, I'm not leaving your office till you commission this. And we were given zero budget. It was like, just, I can't even tell you how little I was paid for that. It was like just mad, mad little money. I was like kind of paid the same as, you know, kind of what you'd give like a sort of somebody who did a vox pop basically on telly. And we wrote this series and it was quite good. It was good. And we were really pleased with it. It was sort of a pastiche of history programs and we recreated moments in history. So, that, you know, that was good. And I think that was the thing that sort of gave us the confidence to feel like, you know, we might be able to do this for a living. And then, but I would say, I mean, I'm very proud of the many things I've done over the years. And, I've created like sitcoms and all sorts of things. But I would say that the Battersea Poltergeist was the first time that I felt like I made something that just was totally 100% the thing I wanted it to be, with no element of compromise. You know, I sort of felt like prior to that, I'd always sort of compromised to some degree, kind of trying to fit it to a certain tone for a channel or whatever. But actually, just to make something that just felt like totally me was really, you know, invigorating and kind of empowering.
Well, with that in mind, given its importance to you, what is the opening scene to Undanny? Is it, do we start with the Battersea Poltergeist? Are we doing that kind of thing where people do sometimes, where the films do sometimes, they start at a middle point and then have a kind of wibbly wobbly timeline? Or would you want to go back to the very beginning of everything and be in a kind of more linear storytelling progression?
I think it's a really good question. I think now more and more you have that thing of kicking off with a scene from later on, don't you, to kind of hook people in, draw people in, you kind of show them the end to make them want to stay with you. It's a kind of real thing that's kind of emerged from Netflix, isn't it? You've got to kind of hook people in the first minute or so. Yeah, so I'm kind of torn. You know, like my earliest memory is of a big hill in Whitstable. I spent the first 3 years of my life in Whitstable in Kent, and I've got this kind of almost dreamlike memory of a big hill. You know, I also, like, you know, some of my seminal early memories are arriving in the Northeast. You know, I arrived in the Northeast age three. We moved into this former mining community, Washington, and it was the time of the miners' strike. And I remember that being a time of real conflict. You know, that's a kind of dramatic place to kick off, isn't it? You know, that kind of class war, that struggle between the government and the miners, you know, which kind of basically tore the heart out of that region, the Northeast, and left a kind of a devastation that still kind of is felt to this day. I also remember dressing up as Adamant to get out of going to town and going shopping with my parents, which dates me horribly. But these are all seminal early memories. But I do think I would veer towards something exciting to draw people in. I mean, I've had so many moments in recent years that I never thought I would have, you know, moments that have kind of blown me away and made me pinch myself, like going to the premiere of my play in Los Angeles. That was
wow,
just really exciting. But I think, you know, I might lean into something that shows a kind of fear and a weakness, actually. You know, I think that scaring people in your first scene is important. If, you know, I'd like this to be a horror movie. And I feel like, you know, maybe you need to see me scared. So the two scariest moments in my life, and I've written about this recently for my book, one is going to Luke Skywalker's house, which I'll clarify by saying it was
you went to Tatooine,
not Tatooine,
and you stepped over the burning skeletons of Aunt Uncle and Aunt Beru.
Yeah, well, I almost it was not Tatooine. It was old Luke. It was the island in The Last Jedi. You know, the island you see at the end of The Force Awakens. I can't remember what it's called in those movies. It's got a sort of complicated name, but in actual life, it's called Skellig Michael, and it's just off the coast of Ireland, and it's actually the westernmost point in Europe, apart from Iceland, and it's this kind of incredibly brutally rocky outcrop where some monks built a monastery on top of it in the 8th century, I think, and it's, you know, it feels impossible. How the hell did they do it? It's like basically just shards of rock with this monastery sitting on top, and the only way to get up to the monastery is these kind of stone steps hewn into the rock, with no handrail at all. And I walked up it, I managed to get up there, but coming down is the most scary thing I think I've ever done in my life. I've got a really terrible phobia of heights, and coming down this thing in the wind and the rain, these steps like bars of soap. I watched a guy in front of me nearly fall to his death.
Oh my God.
And my legs were literally shaking, swinging back and forth like pendulums. And that kind of level of fear, that kind of level of adrenaline, I wonder if that's a good place to start the movie. The other place.
It's an epic, sorry to interrupt, but it's like a completely epic setting for an opening scene.
And that really is.
Acto? Is that what it's called? Acto?
I think it's something like that. You know, so, I mean, there wouldn't be porgs in my version of it, obviously. But do you know the story of the porgs? Those little weird creatures.
No, there, go on.
They were CGI created to cover up the puffins. There's so many puffins on that island that they couldn't edit them out. There was no way they could film and not get puffins in shot. So the director created porgs to hide them. But so it's either that or a moment in my early 20s where I was convinced I was dying. I was lying on the floor of my bathroom in my parents' house, and I was convinced I was having a heart attack. My heart was pounding from my chest like a jackhammer, and I thought I was dying. And it turned out it was a panic attack, and it you know, it wasn't deadly, but it was truly terrifying. I mean, in that moment, I thought I was dying. So I think that also for me would be a moment that has shaped my life so much, I think, in terms of how I've lived my life, and certainly my interest in the paranormal, I think, is really shaped by that fear of death and that idea that I don't want death to be the end, you know. So I think that those moments would be vying. I think I'm going to go for Skellig Michael, probably just for the sheer kind of Hollywood bang for your buck of that kind of rocky outcrop in the middle of the sea.
I mean, like I say, it's an epic location for an opening scene. And if you don't mind, I just wonder, the panic attack, is that something, do you still have them? Is that, or have you learned to kind of manage to kind of bring them under control? I've had them in the part. I mean, I've had my own experience at that. So I understand kind of how they feel.
I think so many people have. And I you know, since I wrote my book, I've had people contacting me and emailing me about it and saying that they've had that experience, and also that horrible crippling fear of death, which is a horrible sort of nihilistic kind of just depressing thing to have, you know, to think that you're dying all the time. I went through months, really. I went through the best part of a year thinking I was dying every second of the day, that every little twinge in my body was a heart attack or a brain tumor. And it was it was exhausting, utterly exhausting and debilitating. And, you know, I couldn't enjoy life at all. And you know, and what I say to the people who write to me is, it gets better. You know, I think you do reach a moment where you can deal with it. I found that the thing that helped me was talking to somebody. I went and talked to I don't know if it was a psychologist or a psychiatrist, I can't remember now, but, you know, somebody who was there to help on the NHS, and went and talked to them. And they just sort of explained to me about why my body was doing it, and that my body was kind of overreacting to a kind of fear that wasn't there, you know, that I was going to sort of fight or flight over something that, you know, I mean, fight or flight is really useful if you're being chased by a tiger. You know, it'll make you run faster, it'll make you possibly be able to survive, but it's really useless if you're just in everyday life and you're, you know, just going for a normal life, because that heightened level of fear is damaging and exhausting. And so, you know, I once I discovered that, once I kind of learned that and started kind of realizing that I was to some degree in control of it, the you know, the fear morphed into kind of anxiety, and then into like kind of low-level worry, and eventually kind of did sort of disappear. And, you know, I still retain a kind of residual fear of death, but not in that kind of overwhelming way. And so I think, you know, anybody listening who is going through that kind of stuff, talk to people about it, you know, learn why it's happening, learn the kind of mad way your brain works, you know, and slowly things will get better. And it feels horrendous and awful, and it feels like, you know, you'll never escape from it, but the good news is that you will.
I'm sort of going to follow on with a serious question, but it is that it's so important to know that, well, it does improve. But that fear of death you talk about is making the podcasts and investigating these stories. Is that something, not quite aversion therapy, but is that kind of a way to sort of deal with that fear of death if there's a residual fear of death?
I think it really definitely is. And I think if we're honest, probably it's why a lot of us are fascinated by ghost stories and the paranormal, because of that funny paradox that they scare us, but they offer hope. You know, it's there for all of us. It's why we have religions, you know, to try and explain what happens to us when we die, and to offer the hope that it's not the end, because I think it just doesn't seem to make sense, doesn't it? It feels so pointless that we'd spend all this time accumulating the trappings of a life, you know, and communicating. You know, I mean, we communicate so much, you know, we've evolved as human beings to the point where we can send millions of words with the touch of a button. We kind of communicate nonstop, and we, you know, store all our communications. We've got reams and reams of photos and words everywhere, and all these kind of relationships we build. And the idea that it just stops and ceases and it was all a waste of time feels horrible, doesn't it? You know, so the idea that there is something more is deeply, deeply seductive. And I think, you know, every case I investigate offers that little glimmer of hope. And so, yeah, for me, you know, it's a deeply optimistic journey that I am on.
I don't know if you ever saw this. It was on Twitter, but someone posted a thing that they read about Roger Ebert, the film critic and writer. His final words. Have you ever seen this before?
No.
And I hope it's true. But the guy basically posted a sort of clip of a screenshot rather of what his final words were. The guy kind of quote tweeted and said, "This has just been on my brain for like ever since I've read it. I've kind of can't forget it." And it kind of touches on what you spoke about there. Apparently, Roger Ebert's final words were, "This is all an elaborate hoax." And when that was, when he was asked what did he meant, he said, "This whole thing is an illusion." And like, yeah, that's a phrase which I find that deeply compelling and also sort of not worrying, but
but it's kind of a cunning thing to do with your last words, isn't it, to kind of pose a puzzle.
I had a similar thought, Danny. I was like, God, you know, the people like 120 and say, "Oh, do you know what the secret to long life is? Fags and booze." Yeah. And they're like, yeah, stitch everyone up.
But if, you know, if your final words were like, you know, "I finally have the answer," or like, you know, "I see it all now," then, you know, we love cliffhangers, don't we?
Well, I mean, we've got the opening scene. We've got this epic opening scene. We'll get to the cliffhanger at some point. But I just wondered who is going to be on those stone steps on that island? Who is going to be cast as Danny Robbins in Undanny?
Good question. So, I mean, obviously we need to consider Tom Cruise, action hero who does all his own stunts. I personally veer away from Cruise, even though we sort of share a certain kind of pronounced nose.
I thought you said athleticism.
That as well. I mean, I'd happily drive a motorbike off a cliff. But I think I veer away from him on account of his Scientology, actually, because I have Scientologists in my family, and Scientology has kind of created quite a rift in our family. There's a lot of drama. And my cousin and her husband kind of fled from Scientology, and actually she ended up in the Leia Rimini TV series, and my cousin's husband was in the Louis Theroux film. He's one of the main people in the Louis Theroux film. So that's been very dramatic in our family. That's a whole sort of, you know, that could be a subplot in the film. But so I'm going to veer away from that, despite his amazing athleticism. Now the people I was always compared to as a young chap were indie pop stars, Brit pop stars. I kind of had people come at me all the time going like, "Are you Jarvis Cocker? Are you Damon Albarn? Are you Brett Anderson? Are you Johnny from Menswear?" That was the slightly more insulting one. I had a big floppy fringe. I loved all that. So, you know, in their day, maybe one of those could have played me. Maybe Brett Anderson could have made his movie debut. But you know who I'm going to go for?
Please.
I'm going to go for Matthew Bainton off of Ghosts and Horrible Histories. A, because my kids love him. And B, just because I think he's a great actor who embodies a certain sort of vulnerability and sensitivity, as well as great comedy bones as well. So I'm going to go for him. I'd like to see him in a role that sort of pushes him into comedy, but also action as well.
So, yeah, what do you think? What do you think he'll find most challenging about playing you in Undanny?
Ooh, that's a good one. I don't know. It's the hair, really, isn't it? I spend a lot of time getting my hair exactly how I want it. It's been commented on that I'm kind of constantly ruffling my fringe and trying to make it sit exactly right. So, yeah, I think a lot of time in hair and makeup just to get that fringe perfect.
I am someone who despises the wind for the similar reasons. The Barnet has to be correct. So,
and also, I always thought it was complete rubbish, that idea of having a better side. Like, someone told me a story recently about how David Beckham insists on being filmed from one side. And I thought, that's rubbish, isn't it? That's rubbish. And I realised, actually, making my teleseries, that I do have a better side. And there's one side that I'm really happy with. I really like the way I look. And the other side, I'm like, oh, I'm not quite so keen on that, you know. So, you know, I like my hair to fall a certain way. I like my fringe to go to one particular side, you know. So, yeah. You become very vain when you do telly. Like, I sort of... all the years of kind of writing and doing radio and podcasting and so on, I never really needed to think about how I looked. And then just making the Uncanny TV series last year, I found suddenly kind of, you know, I've always been quite vain, but I sort of found new levels of vanity and kind of found myself going for expensive facials and buying more expensive moisturizers. And just, you know, obviously it doesn't really, really matter what I look like. But like, you know, when I think about sort of people you know, particularly female presenters and actresses who are constantly judged by their looks. I mean, just therein madness lies. If you're kind of constantly worrying about how you are perceived, and people are so horrible, aren't they? Like, you know, some of the things recently about actresses or, you know, kind of famous women being criticized for how they look, it's, you know, that's nerve-wracking. So yeah, casting a handsome man like Matthew Benton to come and play me is a good strategy, I think.
Well, also, it's a great strategy in that I think you said earlier that the next question was, what genre would the film be? And I think you said horror. And of course, he's part of the Ghost team, so he should be very comfortable with this kind of material. So would Undanny be a horrible history, if you like, with Matthew Benton in there?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I love horror films and have done. I was a bit of a late adopter to horror films. I kind of think I got into them as a student, really. I remember watching Scream and loving it, and then actually going back and kind of watching all the films that inspired Scream, because obviously Scream is quite postmodern, quite referential to different things from the past. And I just love it as a genre. And I think there's a real correlation between comedy and horror. And you see quite a few people making that move. Like, you know, Jordan Peele would be the absolute apex of that, you know, that kind of going from sketch comedy to making amazing Oscar-winning horror movies. Alice Lowe, you know, somebody else who's you know, brilliantly done both. Gareth Tunley, who made The Ghoul. I don't know how many people know that film, The Ghoul, but he was part of the kind of Ealing comedy sketch team crowd that the Horrible Histories team sprung out of as well. There were kind of used to be these old nights at Ealing Studios that I took part in as well, where they did loads of kind of live sketch comedy and loads of brilliant people. Alice Lowe came out of that scene as well. Lots of brilliant people came out of that scene. The people who made Paddington as well, Paul King. And I think there's this real correlation. I think as a comedian, as a comedy writer, you think in terms of kind of ticking boxes. You know, you tick. I remember literally ticking off the jokes on the page when I used to do radio comedy. Like when they got the laugh, you tick them off. You know, and it's like, horror is the same. You kind of, you know, you're scared. You've got to hit those beats. You know, it's a very it's so kind of either right or wrong. As an audience, you know, you either love or hate comedy. You know, you emerge from comedy going, it was shit, I hated it, it didn't make me laugh. You know, you'd never do that with a drama. You kind of just, you can go like, yeah, it was okay, it was all right. You know, you don't have that kind of extremity of opinion. And I think horror is the same. Like, if horror doesn't scare you, it's utterly failed, you know. So it's an art form, I think, that attracts people who aren't afraid to take risks. You know, you've got to be kind of quite bold, I think, and just go for it. But also it's a certain kind of mind. I think it's quite a sort of technical brain. You know, I love that. I was talking before about that idea of the rhythm of it, feeling a kind of musicality of it. And I think, you know, feeling those scares and hitting those beats, I love that aspect of it. And I also love mixing comedy and horror. So I think, you know, my film would have humor indefinitely. And, you know, the words comedy and horror when put together normally kind of instill the wrong kind of fear. You know, there's a lot of very shite comedy horror films. But I remember going to see Woman in Black as a teenager and noticing,
oh my God, the stage show.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And noticing that when people got scared and screamed, the next thing they did was laugh, you know, to try and reassure themselves. And I thought that's a heady brew, that. And so 222 is very much that, you know, that mixture of, you know, laughing and being scared, you know, uppers and downers, you know, kind of lull people into a full sense of security with laughter and then hit them with a scare and then let them relax with laughter. And, you know, and it's quite powerful, that, I think.
Well, I mean, they're both reveals, aren't they? Horror and comedy are both about reveals. Like, the horror, horror is about scaring someone and not them not seeing what was coming and being so surprised by it. And then that's the same for comedy, I think, as well. Like, the punchline suddenly hits them and they weren't seeing it, and they're involuntary responses. And
yeah, you know, it's releasing something quite powerful in us, I think. When you sit in a room and laugh, or sit in a room and feel scared, it's that transporting power, that kind of cathartic thing. I mean, to go back to Greek drama, they talked about that kind of desire for the kind of catharsis for the, you know, the audience to be kind of transported and to sort of, you know, something to be released. And I think comedy and horror do that.
Often in films, horror films, you have those moments where something scary happens and then there's a kind of like a release, like, you know, there's a huge shadow or something and people think, oh my God, it's the monster. And then it's actually a cat. And then the character often laughs and the audience kind of laughs along with them. Like, that's probably the only time in a horror film people do things that normal people would do. Because other times they stay in places they shouldn't do. They go investigate sounds they shouldn't go and investigate. Like, that's the one time it's always seemed to me, like, when those characters in those films sort of laugh to relieve themselves of the stress they're currently experiencing. That is like the single moment that we can actually appreciate. Everything else is like, dude, what are you doing? Like, this is a terrible idea.
Yes, I know. I mean, I think so often in horror, it's about what you don't do as well. You know, I think that those moments where it builds to a scare but isn't are so crucial. And I think the real challenge in horror is how to sustain it, you know. And I've heard it said in the past that the best ghost stories are short stories, you know. And I think that's kind of I think, you know, there are good long ago stories, and The Woman in Black would be a great example of that. But I think it is very hard once you've shown your ghost to sustain peril and fear, you know, because once you've seen the monster, you know, once you know what the monster is, it's easier to face, you know. And I think it's masterful to pull off an ability to kind of have a villain that remains scary, I think, you know. And you know, so I think a lot of the tricks of being a horror maker is of hiding and not showing. And I think, you know, like in 222, I was very conscious of wanting to mine a lot of real world scares. So, you know, there are scares from the kind of the noises of foxes in the garden, or they're just, you know, the kind of crackle of the baby monitor, or just, you know, the burglar lights going on outside. You know, lots of things that kind of breed a sense of tension and unease, so that actually you can kind of keep your supernatural powder dry, you know, kind of ration the actual supernatural scares, because, you know, you're getting people into a real sense of tension just from the kind of the world, you know, their normal, the mundanity of their environment.
I was going to ask next, what parts of your life would definitely have to be in Undanny? Are we talking, would parts of your life include a crackle over the baby monitor, a burglar light coming on, those kind of things? But are the meatier parts of your life, what would have to be in there?
Yeah, well, you know, I think any movie needs a love story. I'm very lucky that I have had a love story in my life, and that I really did have love at first sight. I was performing on stage in the Etc. Theatre above the Camden, at the Oxford Arms pub in Camden. And I was doing a preview of an Edinburgh show, and I looked out into the audience and I saw the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen in my life. And she was blonde-haired and blue-eyed, and she looked at me, and I could feel a sort of a real chemistry. I could feel like a kind of, you know, an electric charge in the air. And I felt like I needed to talk to her immediately after the show, and I did. And luckily, she'd felt that very same feeling, you know, and it was quite magical, really. And she's now my wife, you know, Eva. And we were sort of inseparable from that day onwards, really. And she's from Sweden originally. And you know, she's obviously such a huge part of my life. She's, you know, she's my best friend as well as my kind of life partner. And so Sweden has become a big part of my life as well. And we go to Sweden a lot now, because we go and see her parents. And so that's something that I would never have expected prior to that point being a part of my life. You know, this kind of the Swedish connection. So I think you'd need to see quite a bit of Sweden in this movie. You'd need to see those kind of idyllic summers, the lakes, swimming in the lakes, and the kind of amazing winters, the kind of the snow and the kind of, you know, the beautiful white lights flickering in the windows of the Christmas lights. So all of that, I think, would play a really big role. And obviously my kids now as well. I've got two beautiful kids, Leo and Max, and that would be a big part of it. And so I think that would ground our hero in real life, you know, his family. That would give him stakes and jeopardy, something to protect and hold on to as he fought against the horror. But I guess, you know, you would definitely need to embrace the dark side as well. And you know, I think you'd want to see me out on ghost hunts and investigating mysteries, and also perhaps my teenage goth side as well. I was a teen goth. Well, when I say I was a teen goth, I was actually not. I was a closet goth. I was in a goth band. I got kicked out for not goffing up. I loved goth music. I was well into Sisters of Mercy. I think I was just not quite brave enough to be a goth. I've goffed up subsequently. I went to Whitby Goth Weekend and got fully goffed up for
a place to be a goth. I mean, what a place to come out of the goth closet.
I think you can see that on YouTube. If you look on YouTube, you can see me goffed up on that, I think. And look at Whitby Goth Weekend Culture Show, I think it is. Like, you'll find me. I did a piece for the Culture Show on BBC Two about going to Whitby Goth Weekend and goffed up. And I like to think I goffed up pretty well. But I also took part in a football match, which was goths versus locals. And and got physically sick from running around after about 5 minutes. I realized I was more unfit than a team of goths. But yeah, I was very interested in the occult as a teenager as well. I read lots of Aleister Crowley, and I had a spell book. I used to kind of meet up with some friends who were goths and put on black cloaks and kind of, you know, talk about doing rituals. I was fascinated by that side of things, I think, you know. So I'd like this movie to have a kind of certain sort of folk horror tinge to it, I guess, and the sort of, you know, shades of the occult and witchcraft and stuff like that. I think we need a sort of subplot about a coven of witches in there somehow.
I mean, wait, there is so much there, Danny. It's such a there is such a rich tapestry, as they say. Look, I like the occult. I mean, but I you know, the Usborne Guide to the Supernatural is like one of my favorite books as a child. And I've still got my copy in the other room. But you actually had a spell book and tried to do spells, or sort of came close to trying to do spells and didn't?
I think, you know, like a lot of teenagers, you feel very powerless, and you're quite interested in the idea of something that gives you power. And I do think the occult is something that interests kids at that age for that reason, actually. And so, I mean, I kept a book where I was writing down spells that I found in books. I was, you know, kind of voraciously going through books about magic, you know, in the library. You know, these were the days where you had to go to the library. You know, you couldn't research stuff on the internet. Again, dating myself there, but like... you know, I'd go to the library, I'd find these books, I'd buy books in kind of shops. I was quite interested in Enochian magic, the magic of Dr. John Dee, the Elizabethan philosopher and kind of wizard, if you like. And Aleister Crowley, I'm very interested in, you know, I guess, you know, it wasn't a particularly healthy interest, I think. And, you know, I never used any of these spells, but it was like, you know, the spells I was collecting were things that could give you power or sort of, you know, stop your rivals and all that kind of thing. There's something I find something quite deliciously fascinating about that kind of the dark side, and I quite enjoy music like that. I'm a big fan of a Swedish band called Ghost, who are this kind of melodic metal band that the lead singer dresses as a satanic bishop, and the backing guys all play guitars and dressed as kind of evil monks. So I think I'd like Ghost to do the soundtrack for it, actually.
Well, before we move on, there is a very fine line between a cult and camp, isn't there? Like, it's not...
definitely.
The dressing up and...
They're happy bedfellows.
Yeah, yeah. And I did wonder, you talked about love at first sight with Eva. Like, as someone who is interested in unusual phenomena, which is hard to kind of really pin down, love at first sight, does that interest you as a kind of phenomenon?
Well, I think attraction is a very, very real thing, isn't it? You know, and it's funny, my wife made a documentary on a condition called genetic sexual attraction, which is like when people who are kind of long lost relatives who've never ever known each other in life meet up and are attracted to each other, you know, kind of sexually attracted to each other, because they sort of see elements of themselves, you know. And you know, because if you grow up together, like if you're, you know, siblings or parents, whatever, you grow up together, nature does something to kind of inhibit that, you know. You kind of do not fall in love with your close family. But if you haven't had that, if you've been separated, that's kind of removed, and it's this kind of, you know, horrible and quite upsetting thing that people sort of do kind of fall in love with their, you know, long lost brothers or fathers, you know. But there's something about, you know, that there is a strong pull. Attraction is an incredibly strong pull, you know, and we are attracted to certain things. We're attracted to certain types, I guess. And maybe we are attracted to kind of people who sort of, we feel are kind of similar to us in a way, you know. I sort of feel like when I met Eva, like she made me laugh a lot, you know, and I love that. That was a thing that really attracted her to me. I mean, we don't look similar in any way. She's much more attractive than me. But I you know, I think, you know, we've got a similarity, you know, the kind of, there's many things we share that we have in common, you know, and I think that's why we work together, but also lots of things that are very, very different, I guess. So we have that kind of yin and yang thing as well. But I don't know. I mean, you know, it's, I don't think there's anything paranormal or supernatural about love at first sight. I think it's just that you, you know, attraction is a very real and definite thing. And when you sort of meet somebody who is like the person who attracts you more than anybody else, then that's a very lucky and brilliant thing to hit, you know. So I guess, you know, that's where you get into the lottery of life, you know, and kind of it happened to be a brilliant coincidence that we were there together in that room that night, you know, and I sort of thanked my lucky stars.
You remember her, that moment so vividly, seeing her for the first time. Was she wearing black? Was she your woman in black?
Oh, gosh, that is a very good question. She may have been. I can't remember now. Yeah, well, let's say she was for the movie. We'll definitely go that way.
For the sake of this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
For the
sake of this. Let's write that in. We'll put that in the early draft.
Well, there's so much to go into the film, but which moments would you want on the cutting room floor? Which pieces of your life would you not want in the film for whatever reason?
I think I definitely put the bit where I just talked about a documentary about incest in the whilst talking about how much I love my wife. That bit would definitely go, that bit would go on the cutting room floor. No, I've had some traumatic things happen in my life. One of them was going to school in sixth form wearing just dungarees with nothing underneath. So my skinny, pasty little body, little bony shoulders, everything like that, totally bare-chested, but just wearing my mum's dungarees over the top. And it was the longest day. There's a movie called The Longest Day, isn't there? This was genuinely the longest day, getting through that, being mocked to bits in a tough northeastern school.
Oh my God.
So that would go, for sure. And I also remember wearing those very same dungarees in the Cooperage nightclub on the Quayside in Newcastle and lying on the floor of the toilets, vomiting with the dungarees around my ankles whilst people stood and looked down at me. That would probably go. I remember a deeply, deeply traumatic incident from even earlier childhood. I would have been, I'm going to say about reception here. I think I was probably about 4 years old, something like that. And I was, here's a nice bit of colour for the movie. I was the only vegetarian, it seemed, in the entire northeast of Britain in the 1980s. I was the only vegetarian I knew, the only vegetarian at my school. And I was looked on as a freak as a result of that, and nobody understood it. Everyone was annoyed by it. I would just get the meat eaters thing without the meat, with a little pile of crappy processed cheese instead. But I had this headmistress who was, she was probably part of that generation that had grown up with rationing, you know, kind of lived through the war, and kind of was very annoyed by food wastage and whatever, and didn't like the fact that not only was I vegetarian, I was a bit of a picky eater. I wasn't kind of eating my food all the time, and she picked on one thing. She picked on baked beans, and she was like, you know, why won't you eat the baked beans? And I said, I don't like the tomato sauce. And actually, here's another little subplot to this. My gran asked me why I didn't like baked beans. I said, it's because they've got blood in them, gran. I was associating the baked bean sauce with blood, you know, so read into that what you will. But anyway, I said, I don't like the tomato sauce. And so the next day she came back and she had drained some baked beans of their tomato sauce and stood over me and forced me to eat cold, sauceless baked beans. And it was horrible. And I wept into them, kind of salty tears falling onto those dry, unlovely beans. And it was just, you know, a very early memory of an adult being totally unfair and totally unjust. And, you know, I mean, God knows why, you know, adults in that era kind of engaged in all sorts of levels of sadism to kids in a way that they don't and can't now, thankfully, you know. But it's just, you know, like, what was it to her that I wasn't eating baked beans, you know? And then so that would have to hit the cutting room floor, I think, as well. But, you know, I don't know, maybe you put that in, maybe that's formative memories.
It's almost Dickensian. Like, and also how much effort. But what little, what was the reward from all that effort was upsetting a child, having to strain it and then sieve it and then all that kind of stuff.
I know. I mean, the level of preparation, scary.
The dungarees, you obviously snaffled them from your mum.
Did
you ever return them? And have you ever worn dungarees
since?
I'm
not sure she would have wanted them back after that, I think. After a teenage boy, a sweaty teenage boy wore them, I don't know. I think I kept them. And I remember Vanilla Ice, I'm really dating myself for this. I'm hating it. But I remember he had this kind of fashion of wearing his dungarees kind of folded down, you know, like sort of with the thing hanging over, like a kilt kind of thing. So I remember doing that quite a bit, actually, wandering around. He was definitely somebody I was very heavily influenced by in terms of fashion and style, you know. I mean, to this day, I would say.
And I just wondered, actually, what were the influences on the film from TV, literature, or comics? Would there be certain influences on Danny?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I would draw on all the things that kind of inspired me as a kid, like Hammer horror movies and you know, Scream. Obviously, I mean, you know, like lots of kind of horror movie influences. Don't Look Now is one of my favorite horror movies. I mean, beautifully shot. I'd love it to be as beautifully shot as that. That kind of the Nick Roeg beautiful cinematography. I mean, all of that would kind of go into it. And I just think I'd like it to have a kind of dark aesthetic to it. But yeah, but I think funny, like it's got to have laugh out loud moments as well. Like, you know, I think, you know, I have written comedy my entire adult life. I think this would be very wrong if this movie wasn't a movie that made you laugh out loud in the cinema.
Well, if the critics love it or hate it, Undanny, how would that affect you in your next project? Do you listen to critics?
Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean, I think all of us do. And I think, you know, I think you're a fool if you don't, because I think, you know, ultimately, you know, it's a big part of the job, you know, and you know, we need critics. We use critics. We put what critics say on posters and we sell our work using critics. So to be dismissive of that, I think is foolish. You know, I think one thing I've noticed over recent years that I think is interesting is that there is definitely a disconnect between what some critics think and write and, you know, what you know, actual real people watching things think. I think sometimes critics get hung up on very small kind of niche minutiae elements of things that you know the average punter never thinks about, and I certainly read reviews where I totally don't agree with the critic, you know. And I think, you know, I mean, there was one recently of Super Mario Brothers where it said basically, you know, children might enjoy this film, but, you know, they're hardly the best judges. Guardian review. And and I was like, well, good, but it's for kids. It's for kids. You know, kids enjoy a kids movie. That's a good thing. And I think it went on to say, like, you know, the only sort of people who will enjoy this are people who like Nintendo games or children. And you go, that's who it's for, you know. So I think, you know, sometimes it's frustrating to see critics write stuff where you sort of feel like they've sort of ignored the fact that it's massively successful in terms of being enjoyed by the audience it was made for. The whole nature of being a critic has changed a lot, hasn't it? You know, I think a critic used to be somebody who was absolute expert in their field and knew everything about it. Now there's been a kind of democratization of it where anyone can be a critic. You know, you can write your review on social media and say what you like. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of newspapers and magazines have kind of stopped investing in criticism in the way that they used to. A lot of critics have been laid off. Some brilliant theatre critics and film critics have been laid off in recent years. And I think that's a real shame, because the idea of having an expert giving their expert opinion, I think, is quite important, really. But yeah, I mean, it's always nerve-wracking. I remember an Edinburgh festival promoter I had saying to me, Danny, if you want to believe you're a king, you've also got to believe you're a C word. And I thought it was kind of quite good advice in some ways, you know, like, you know, if you want to believe the good stuff, you've also got to believe the bad stuff. But I was like, actually, I was like, no, Nigel, I want to believe the good stuff. You know, if people write good stuff about me, I think they're right. If they write bad stuff, I think they're wrong, you know, and that's fine. But, you know, sometimes you do read critical reviews where you feel like they've definitely got it right and they help you see your work in another way. And I remember, like, reading a couple of reviews about the first leg of the Uncanny Tour, which were, you know, really nice, positive reviews, but contained like one or two elements of criticism in them. And I was like, yeah, actually, that's right. That's good. And that's sort of things that we've changed for when we go out on the second leg, you know. So I think, you know, it's, as we said at the very beginning of this, you know, like a world where nobody criticizes you and where, you know, you kind of think you're perfect is a world where you are out of control and mad.
Well, also the thing about, I think the problem that you touched upon there is also the knee jerk. Everything, this is the worst thing in the world. That is somehow seen as a kind of like relevant view when it's clearly just the most extreme view, and there's no nuance, and, you know, there's no explanation as to why it's the worst thing in the world. Mm. It's just literally people saying, I hate it, it's terrible. That's then kind of weaponized against whatever it might be in order to then build a story around that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, you saw a real critical pile-on recently for that play about the Enfield haunting in the West End, you know, got many one-star reviews, and I went to see it, and it absolutely wasn't a one-star show. You know, it was kind of flawed, but it was, you know, in no way kind of as bad as the critics were saying. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's hard. I think we deal in extremes now. Everything is extreme, isn't it? You know, we're living in the age of Trump. Everything is louder and, you know, angrier and more extreme than it ever was before. So I think, you know, critics embrace that, and I guess, you know, they smell blood and they sort of, you know, it can lead to a pile on. But, you know, it's terrifying. I mean, I do wonder if critics think about the human cost of their reviews and the, you know, the people behind it. Because reading those reviews for The Enfield Haunting, I, you know, thought about how I would feel if I was the writer of that or the director of that reading it. And I think it would break me to a degree where, you know, I think it would be just brutally upsetting, you know, and I think it would really harm your confidence, you know. I mean, maybe those guys are kind of tougher and sort of harder skin than me, I don't know, but you know, I try not to. I don't read bad reviews now. I mean, I do read good reviews. I know lots of people who don't read any reviews, you know. I work with a director who doesn't read any reviews, but I don't read the bad reviews anymore, because I think you kind of don't need that in your head, you know. It's a hard thing. You need to say the truth as a critic, and yet at the same time it's hard, you know. There are real people who are making this stuff, and nobody set out to make something bad.
Where would the premiere take place, and who is invited?
So I would go to the Shard, definitely the Shard. I went there recently with my kids, and it was just so much fun looking down, seeing trains that look like toy trains. So yeah, at the top of the Shard, lots of celebs, but also lots of actual real people as well. I would want like lots of the Uncanny fans, the Uncanny community to come to it.
And who is absolutely not invited, and why?
Well, the headmistress who fed me baked beans, I think. But I'm sure, sadly, she's passed away now. She was very old then, but she wouldn't be welcome. And just anybody who's unkind, basically. I sort of feel like, you know, we need to make a stand. I think there's too much unkindness in the world right now. So I would have a kind of kind counter as we come in. Like, it was sort of like a karmic kind of thing. Like, have you been kind? Are you a nice person? Yes, you're welcome. You can come to the top of the Shard and watch the movie. So
you almost need like one of those EPK meetings meters from Ghostbusters just to read people as they come in. Like, yeah. How much kindness have you got?
Yeah. An EP kind meter. Yeah, exactly. There you go.
Well, there we have it. Undanny, a horror comedy starring Matthew Baton, featuring Menswear, The Battersea Poltergeist, The Mysterious Lodger, Vanity, Love at First Sight, A Goth Football Match, Dungarees, and Cold Sauceless Baked Beans. Danny Robbins, congratulations on being greenlit.
I can't wait to see it.